listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kourula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest all the way from Seattle, Washington, Mr. Philip Peterson. How are you, Philip?
I'm doing really well. It's been, you know, things have been getting kind of back to normal and getting really busy. So it's been a little crazy. I think that a lot of us are a little bit, shall we say, out of shape with being busy. And so I'm like, oh, yeah, this.
You're like, I remember when this works.
Yeah, I remember when things used to be like this. And I
let's talk right about that real quick. The pandemic happens. You know, for me, it was like business as usual. I'm sure it was like that on some level for you, like minus the live shows, because your room looks like mine. It's like we're like mad scientists in a lab, you know, so. Yeah. I know you're working a lot on track. So tell me what that experience was like, just dealing with the pandemic, something new for all of us to kind of work around.
Well, I mean, I really did find that a lot of my clients at lots of different levels in the industry were affected. So, I mean, a lot of bands that would have normally, you know, booked the studio were out there playing shows to get the money to book studio time and then make their record. So not being able to play out really did affect everybody. And that sort of had a trickle up effect where then those people couldn't afford to book time. And then, so we had to start switching gears and we did a lot of live streaming and really learning about some of the tech side of things and doing more remote, which you know, my day job, I mostly am doing remote stuff for people all over the world that send me. So, but also even, you know, your big artists, your really big artists still were losing their shirt, basically, when it comes to like, okay, big tours are being canceled and there's all these mouths to feed and stuff. So I think really everything was very affected. Workflow, not as much because I was already on the remote tip. So I didn't have as much learning curve. But as far as, you know, amount of work and amount of things happening, it definitely got a lot slower.
They say the music industry lost $9 billion from that pandemic.
Wow.
Just from just all the tours that were canceled, all the studios that were out of work. I was in the middle of making a record, and I remember we tracked, I think the last tracking session we had was the Horns right before the pandemic started. It was March 13th or 14th, and then everything shut down. So we had to just wait. I mean, me and the engineer, are we just going to have to do everything with one-on-one sessions? Like, you know, just, it was so weird. But it was also, I was very thankful to have started the remote work because I think for a lot of musicians, it was a transition. For you and me, it was not a transition. It was almost like, okay, we got to buckle up and kind of to start getting more into that. But there were so many musicians that were like, how do you do what you're doing remotely? Like, I don't do that, you know? So I know a lot of people made that transition. So I'm sure you felt the same, that I was like, I was thankful that I had gotten into the remote work, you know, just because it made things kind of like a little bit seamless, you know?
That's exactly how I feel. And really, when it comes to the long-term side of things, I'm really grateful that a lot of these music people ended up getting an interface. And, you know, if anybody's trying to learn music, I always tell them nowadays, it's like, part of your instrument is a digital audio workstation. And if you don't have Phineas in the room next door, you need to learn how to use a microphone and an interface and get your tracks at least kind of okay. You know? So I welcome that.
So let's go way back to when you started playing violin. Tell me what the moment of zen for you was to make you want to pick up the violin, to, you know, start learning music? Did it start with piano? Did it start with strings? Tell me, like, what that moment of zen was for you.
Well, actually, my first instrument was the cello, but it was a violin turned upside down because I was 3 years old.
Right.
And my mom taped an end pin on it. I grew up in a musical family of orc dorks. And so everybody that we knew played an instrument. So it was just kind of like part of growing up. It was like that culture of everybody's invited to play music. And
how old were you when you started playing the cello?
I was 3.
Wow. Seriously?
Yeah.
The cello is so big. How did you even start?
Well, it was an upside down violin.
Wow.
And then incredible. Or viola. I think it was a viola. Yeah, because it had the cello tuning and went from there.
Were you learning, like, you know, preludes? Were you learning, like, symphonies? How do you even start at that age? Or were you learning, like, hot cross buns and just learning
things? Yeah, I mean, it's Twinkle, 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 Little Star is really the one for violin and cello, because you're using a lot of open strings and it's all in first position. And how do you learn it? Well, one note at a time, you know, one string at a time.
And when did you start making the transition to learning other string instruments, or just even how to arrange a little bit?
Well, in elementary school, I was getting bored with the cello, and my dad's a horn player, so he started me on trumpet, and so got into that. And then they needed like a trombone player in the elementary school band, but I didn't want to do the trombone because I already knew the fingering, so I switched to baritone horn, which is like a trombone, only it has valves, and because I already knew those fingerings. So then I switched to that, and then I was still playing cello. And then, of course, high school comes around, and I want to be in a rock band, so somebody gave me an old bass. It's actually that red bass in the shot
behind me. Saw that.
That's my first
corner,
bass.
Right?
Yeah, it's a Japanese Hofner ripoff.
Okay.
But I still have it, and it sounds awesome. And yeah, it was my first bass, and I learned on that and played with my brother's band. And it was just some point.
You're playing in like the orchestra at school. And
right.
And then you'd go and play rock and roll? That's very not like a string player, by the way.
Well, yeah, I mean, music is a language, so you can learn every dialect of a language. It's all, if you know one dialect, it's really easy to start translating and learning the other ones. And frankly, that's actually been a big part of my
Did we lose you?
The people who need things on sheet music, they would hire me to write stuff down on paper from what I'm hearing, and so that's always been part of what I do.
You and I have this parallel with, you know, classical music, and you know, I really a lot of adventurous classical musicians that were down to play rock and roll or even listen to rock and roll. So I love that maybe your family or your friends were that breadth of experience and kind of like, you know, exposing you to other music. Who was playing like what records in your house, or who was that major influence? Was it your brother?
I would say for the rock and roll stuff, my brother was probably the main influence. He was a little older than me, and he kind of knew some stuff and would play pop stuff and rock and roll stuff, and then I got into it. But also my folks, you know, they're of that 60s generation, so they grew they introduced us to all that stuff from the late 60s and early 70s that is just, you know, that foundational stuff, that definitive rock and roll stuff. That
and did you go to music school out of high school? Like, was
Hungarian cello performance. And that was okay. I learned a lot from the private instructor that I was studying with.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Seattle Pacific University, which is just a small college in Seattle. And I studied with Raymond Davis, who was very good. He was the principal of the Seattle Symphony. And so I learned a lot from him. In hindsight, I do wish that I had just gone to business school, though, because I already was good at music.
Right.
And so in hindsight, it's like, yeah, sure, I learned some things, but I could have I could, if I, yeah, I would be a lot more successful if I had just gone to school for business and taken what I had already and run with it.
Yeah, there's, so. There's sometimes I kind of wish either I took, you know, maybe filmmaking classes, business classes, yes. Kind of completely different. I was developing something completely different. But I mean, at that age, you don't know. You think you know, and then you're around all this great talent, and that helps. But it also, you're kind of like growing in that space. So it's like the one thing, and I'm sure you probably may see this now, like it puts you in the environment to hear music more intently. It puts you in the environment where you're kind of like bouncing ideas off people a little bit. That's what I loved about music school for me, was the environment was all music people. So it's like I had this identity that it wasn't really 100% totally set on in high school, because you know you're like partying or like getting into what you think is life, and then that next level, you notice that next level, I think after high school, is a completely different phase. So in that regard, if I was around a bunch of people, I think I'd also different, I'd be that same focus level or film or whatever it is. But the amazing thing is, I know you're like this too, we have all this time now to learn all those things without, you know, like having to take all those classes. But I know what you mean. It's always, I think the essential musician's handbook is to learn business, marketing, all those things, because it's just one of those things that we almost lost you there. It's just one of those things where, you know, marketing is always going to be important, and it's just always going to be a thing to learn how to get your music and your craft out there, you know?
Yeah. So who's to say what I would have learned or not learned and where I would be now, but yeah.
And did you start writing music in college? Did you start playing with other people, joining bands on a more serious level, like the next phase in college?
A string player who could improvise and play by ear and didn't need sheet music, I immediately became pretty sought after in the Seattle area in the studio world. And so I started getting a lot of gigs in college, just at different recording studios for different producers and with different artists, because they were like, they could just sing me a part and I would play it. Or, you know, I would just already hear the parts, and people would hire me to sit in and be like, man, you know what to play with no rehearsal. And I'm like, yeah, I do.
It's,
I can tell where you're going. There's only 12 notes.
Right.
You know?
But it's interesting too, because it's like, to you, you know, a very complex string arrangement is probably very basic, because it's just what you have learned and known your entire life. So it's like when somebody wants this huge orchestral arrangement, you know exactly what approach, very easy ways to make it new for yourself. Do you challenge yourself? What is your creative process like when you're in that space?
Well, every song, every project, every artist is different. And even to the degree that when people are like, oh, what are your rates? I'm like, well, it's all different. So like, what's your budget?
Right.
You know, how much do you want? You're always going to get the same quality from me. But, you know, do you want a 100-piece orchestra, or do you want a cello?
Right.
You know, or do you want some timpani, or do you want horns, or what is it that we're trying to do? You know, every project is different. And also every artist's ability level is different. So if I'm producing somebody and they're like, yeah, how long is it going to take us to do this? And it's like, well, if you're first take Charlie, then come in here and do everything in first takes. It's going to take zero time.
Right.
But if you need a bunch of takes, then that's going to take time.
During producing side, like that became more exciting and kind of more engaging, or did you kind of immerse yourself as the string arranger guy and then wear that different hat as the producer guy when you're doing a record?
I've always been a writer who is sought after as an orchestrator, if that makes sense. I mean, to be a good arranger, you have to be a good composer. But everybody in the music game wants to be a writer or a composer, and not everybody can be the arranger or the orchestrator. So I continue to keep getting hit up for that. That's the special sauce that is, you know, the thing that, you know, the big artists seek out from me. But that's just like having a special sauce. Like the smart people know that if they come and sit at the chef's table, they're going to get a whole meal that may not have in the sauce.
I'll ask you this. When I was in music school and we were learning about theory and composition, there were all these rules, you know, like parallel fifths, like all these like things that you shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever asked you this, but do you ever adhere to those rules, or is it just about what you hear? Because to me, when I'm arranging anything or writing something, it's just about what I'm hearing in that moment, or it's something that is recurring that I'm like, I can't stop hearing this in my head. I want to write this. So tell me what your process is like. Are you thinking about those rules, or are you throwing them all out the window?
I think rules are extremely valuable, especially if you're good enough to break them. You know, I don't want to accidentally do anything. I want to be deliberate about what I'm doing. And if I know what the rules are and I'm choosing to break them, then that's, but dabbling your way through isn't as cool to me.
Right.
I have rules. I mean, for example, unless you want something to sound really murky and dark and stormy and muddy, don't put thirds in the left hand on the piano. Like don't put those tight harmonies down in the lower male vocals.
Right.
You know, go do your bass line and then go up a fifth. Maybe don't do that third in there.
Right.
You know, simple things like that. But I mean, most of my rules are based on not classical rules, but pop rules. Like what happened? Like I ask my clients, like, and my artists that I work with, I'm like, what happens during verse one? Well, the correct answer is nothing happens during verse one. So what instruments are playing on verse one? Well, normally as few as possible.
Right.
Like let's have a vocal and a hi-hat. Let's have just an acoustic guitar.
Right.
Let's have just a piano. Let's have just weird synth sounds. So that,
yeah, but then what about like Eleanor Rigby? Like that is such a great arrangement.
Well, there you go. That's the time to break that rule then.
Right.
So if you know what you're doing, then you can go, this time I'm going to have this thick thing happening.
Right.
But also, there's so much space in between all those notes in Eleanor Rigby. It's so stripped down, really. So it feels kind of like there's a lot happening, but there's a lot of air.
Right.
They're not stepping on the vocals at all.
They're
leaving a ton of room.
So, now, you've worked with some pretty big artists, you know, Maroon 5, Gwen Stefani, Taylor Swift, to name a few. What was it, you know, like every artist is always different. I know every, you know, songwriter or artist is very respectful of working with other musicians. Were there like specific directions that each artist wanted? Was it kind of very like, we love to do, we make working on them?
Yes. every producer is different. Some producers have a very clear idea of exactly this one melody that they want, or this one thing they want me to emulate, which can be really good and a good time saver if somebody knows exactly what they want from me and I give it to them. But my favorite clients are kind of the ones who just say, just go for it, you know, and I can hear what the thing needs. And chances are I've done more string arranging than anyone who's hiring me, or
right.
more orchestration than anyone who's hiring me. So maybe just let me do my thing.
Yeah.
So, but of course I'm there. If you hear a specific line in your head or something, like, let's go.
Was there any artist that was more not driving on the composition side? Was Taylor Swift singing you any string arrangement part or anything? Or is Adam Levine or anybody in his management or anybody in his team kind of saying anything? Or are they just like, what do you hear? What are you going to play, you know?
It runs the whole gamut for sure. I would say that it's the producers kind of overall are the ones who are bringing, who are hooking me up with this work or reaching out to me, not always the artists as much.
Right.
So like, for example, Jack Antonoff is my connection to Taylor Swift and St. Vincent and Lorde and Lana Del Rey. And so he has a lot of times will have very specific ideas of exactly what he wants, but still in a way where it's open-ended. And a lot of times I'll take those risks that he didn't ask for and jump off the cliff. And those are the part that he hit me up for things like, I did the intro for the YouTube version of Juice WRLD Graduation. And Benny Blanco was like, hey, we want this intro. It needs to feel X, Y, Z, but just do your thing. And so I tried a couple different things, and he liked the second one that I made, and they used it, and it turned out really well. So
I remember when you did a string arrangement for me for an artist I was producing, Jessica Bird. I don't know if you remember. This was like 10 years ago. And like I was like, I just gave you a couple of things. I was like, pizzicato in the first verse, lush strings, build it out, you know, like, yeah. And that was it. And man, when you sent me what you sent me back, it was like, okay, I don't need to touch this. Just put everything that he's played right where it needs to be. And it was like, that's when you know you're working with a true artist, because there's no editing. You know, it's like when you know the song as well as the string arrangement is going to fit for the song, that's when it becomes magical to me. It's like, oh yeah, because there's nothing better than working with artists that know what they're doing and have the instinct and can almost hear more than maybe what you're hearing or flesh things out. I mean, I remember you telling me, you're like, yeah, we could just double some of the same strings to sound like more of strings, you know, like, yeah, it's just like, oh, I wouldn't have thought of doing it like that. That's amazing. And it just sounded so huge by the time you finished it. So I always like think about string arrangements as a piano player. Like, I don't think about it as a string arranger. So it's like, I love that you have that instinct, but you've had to have awkward direction. What's the weird, like, that's a weird request, but I'll do it.
Well, a few weeks ago, I went to somebody else's studio that was a good studio and working for a good engineer / producer that had brought me in. But the artist was like too kind of unsure of himself. And so he kept kind of second guessing everything. And I would play stuff, and then he would be like, what if you try this? And I don't know. And he was like very indecisive about what he wanted and didn't want. And then he would try to sing me something that he wanted me to do. And then I would literally parrot that back to him on the track. And he'd be like, no, that's not it. And I'm like, dude, I felt like a blind guy with a Rubik's cube. Like, is this it? Is this it? Can I open my eyes yet? Right. Just let me do my job. Like, right. if he was singing me melodies that he wanted to, like, in the key sort of this, but how am I going to interpret this a fourth up to be in the right key of the song? In
those situations, I try to avoid them like the plague.
That's what I'm saying. So that will be somebody that doesn't get called back.
Honestly, you're so diplomatic. Like I don't know if you feel like this, because I felt like this when I'm in situations like that. My blood starts boiling, because I'm like, because you don't know music, I have to cater to this complete vagueness that is wasting my time.
Yeah. I could have just done this.
Yes. Oh, man.
Could have been over.
From LA, man. You know,
that's kind of like why when people are like, oh, come down to my studio and work. And I'm like, does that mean it's going to take me an hour to get there? And then it's going to take 2 hours to set up. Like, literally all I have to do in my studio is grab my instrument, push one button and hit record. And we're rolling. Like, there's no setup. There's no waiting to bust things or whatever. No. Capture the lightning in the bottle. If you spend too much time sculpting the bottle that you're going to capture the lightning in, then you probably are going to miss out on a lot of lightning.
Well, so, you know, there was a great movie. I wanted to ask you about this score. Natalie Portman starred as Jackie Onassis. I think it was called Jackie. Maybe I'm forgetting the name. But the score was the creepiest and most beautiful compositions. And it was a lot of like sliding strings to create this emotional thing. I'll have to send you some clips. But when I heard that score, it was nominated for an Oscar. It didn't win. And I was kind of pissed, because I was like, this is the most like a soundtrack or for placement or for sculpting a scene that I've ever heard. I haven't heard nobody that's come close to this for a major motion picture, especially, it should win. It was nominated, but are there any scores or arrangements or composers that you hear that you're just like, man, that's a novel approach to this. I love this. I'd be so curious to know because I'm always looking to listen for stuff like that.
I mean, I love Lalo Schifrin. I love Ennio Morricone. I love all those Alfred Hitchcock movies. What's his name? I'm spacing it, but all those Alfred Hitchcock movies that have those spooky orchestrations and stuff. I love that stuff. So I would say those are probably my top three.
Let's play something. What do you want to play us first?
Well, there's this, the Hobo Johnson one could be good because I'm a writer in that. And awesome. And my collaborator came up with this like bloopy piano thing. And then I played a bass line and then Ryan Lewis took it and made all the beats and kind of made it into a production and then pitched it to Hobo Johnson. And then it came out and it was well received. I think it's like got 2.4 million plays on YouTube and
that's awesome.
I'm very proud of it. And it's a good example of not going big with the arrangement, like leaving a lot of space.
Right.
But you can also super hear it's dripping of like my classical background too, if you know what you're listening for. It's like it's basically like a tango.
Well, let's listen. This is Hobo Johnson with Philip Peterson.
Right on.
I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would have bought a Lambo, but I'm not quite there yet. Sometimes I get drunk and I forget what day it is. I wish that I was skinnier, but I love sandwiches. One time I tried to burn sage to clear the vibe, then the smoke alarm went off and my ex-girl cried. She cried for a bunch of other reasons.
I'm never going back to Four Seasons.
I wish that I was friends with Drake so I can dig through his trash and have a yard sale today. Damn, I wish my name wasn't Frank. Fuck! I wish it was Blake. Blake! I learned a lot from my dad, like how to yell a lot and make a car go fast. I wish that I was in the league. I'm a number one pick with two bad knees. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. We're both pretty reliable. Got in a couple accidents. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Lambo, but I'm not quite there yet. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Bentley, but I'm not quite there yet. What's the point of being cool? Cut your hair and get a job like the rest of us do. Don't play guitar in the park and just sit. If I hear another G chord, I'm breaking your shit. Nothing like a Subaru Crosstrek. Suspension is soft as a cute little baby neck. My clique orders club salads and look like they all sing ballads. I could have bought a Lambo happily, but the insurance is high and I kind of want a family. Why does dad have a Lambo? He was insecure about himself, son, let it go. Nothing like fighting another man, cause he cut me off in traffic and my morning started back. I'm glad that his kids got to see that his dad's a giant prick and that he got what he needs. Nothing like crying in a Subaru Crosstrek. Life is an abyss half filled with sadness. My ex-girl's grandpa invented pinball. He had a lot of time on his hands. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Lambo, but I'm not quite there yet. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Bentley, but I'm not quite there yet. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Lambo, but I'm not quite there yet. I just bought a Subaru Crosstrek. I would've bought a Bentley, but I'm not quite there yet.
Hey guys! Have you heard about the all-new Subaru Crosstrek with the new suspension package? If you buy one, you'll be riding smooth in no time. It also came with a trail hitch, but it's only four cylinders, so you probably shouldn't tow anything. My dad said that messes up the transmission.
That was awesome. Very George Zay of you, man. Sounded like Carmen a little bit, man.
Good, yeah. I mean, cello is really fun to do tangos, like tango string quartet, like because you get to be the bass line but have kind of more agility to it than like an upright or an electric would be. And then, I played my
color.
Played my P bass on there too.
Oh, that's awesome. And you know what? I wanted to ask you too, whenever you make an arrangement, are you ever kind of like, not bummed, but kind of, you know that a producer or an engineer took liberties to mix or arrange or pan your strings in a way that maybe you wouldn't have. I'm sure you've heard, like, you recorded stuff and then half of the stuff's not even used or used in the right way. Like, does it kind of piss you off? And I ask only because I've done it. I've laid guitar parts for people that I'm like, oh, this is so killer. And even the other producer or the engineers way into it. And then when it's mixed, it's like mixed so low because you can tell you're like, I don't want this to upstage this other thing that I'm doing, which is, you know, it's their record, it's their project. But like, there's a part of me, it's like, yo, that's when you lose sight of the music on some level, where it's like you're putting too much ego into it. So you when you arrange strings and when you do parts, there has to be times where people just, they hack it. You know, they hack it into pieces and put it in places where you don't. How do you smick, or how do you do that? That would piss you off like it pisses me off.
Well, yeah. All of the above, but normally, you know, with the people that I work with, usually I really trust them. And I actually welcome people using the sauce in an unconventional way or an unexpected way. So a lot of times I will welcome somebody tweaking something, or you playing with it, or putting it through vinyl effects, or making it sound even more black and white movie, or, you know, whatever there's, or, you know, computerizing somehow, making it, you know, glitchy, or scratching it into a sample, or treating it, chopping it up, or whatever. That can all actually be really cool if it's done tastefully. Right. The main thing that I don't appreciate is like when people just completely bury the stuff. It could have been a VST. Like, you could have had Hans Zimmer do this instead of me. Like, if you wanted fake stuff.
And for me, what gets me is that when I'm asked to go to a studio to do it, that pisses me off even more, because it's like, yo, I drove there, I recorded it, and then you didn't really use it in the way that honestly would make the song better if you just didn't get in the way of it, you know? But that, I mean, that's a weird thing about art. It's like, you know, that's the one thing I love about making records or working with musicians, because it's like, you know, people will come to me like, what do you want? I'm like, what do you want to play? And then it becomes this like collaborative thing.
Yes.
Like, oh, you're making something cool. Yeah. And I had so many musicians up tell me, like, man, I love the mix on this. I wasn't expecting you to do such a high horns up mix, or like maybe it's a bass part, or I wasn't expecting a solo in this section. I'm like, man, my songs are vehicles for musicians to play. But yes. I also feel like there's so many people that aren't like that. And it drives me crazy because you know, it's like you put in this time and you have this expertise, and then there's a part of it that's like, I won't say that it's not valued, but it's not really taken into a consideration that can be on the brink of being valued, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a great point. And I'm so fortunate to have just been surrounded by so many collaborators and people that trust me, and also it's a two-way street, because when I hire a musician to come in and work on something that I do, if they're kind of green and they need to be told what to do, then that's fine, and I'll write down the sheet music and they'll play it exactly the way that I wrote it, and that's perfect. That's what sheet music is for.
Right.
And if you've got a yammer yabber babble to me what you want, when you go to how to write the sheet music, then you can tell people and micromanage everybody's ideas.
Right.
But I don't even want to do that with my players. I would rather bring them in and go, you can hear, come on, I already set the pins up. You know how to throw the bowling ball down the middle and knock them all down.
Right.
You know why I asked you here, because I want you to play like you. I want your sensibility. Otherwise, I would get somebody else.
Right.
You know, so I definitely feel that way. And also, you know, I am in this new position now in life where I just don't. I'm tired of chasing the success and chasing the bills getting paid.
Right.
I'm throwing it all out the window, and I'm only working on stuff that I want to work on. Oh, I'm saying no to a lot of things, including big artists.
You know, because what?
Like, if you don't have,
well, and
my
it's all,
time is valuable.
You know, the thing is, it's like part of what I've learned. It's like one of the most important things about being a successful musician or even just a person is saying no. Some things you have to say no to. There's a part of the musician, I think, philosophy in the beginning, especially, you have to say yes to everything.
You do have to
say yes to everything. And then there's a part of it where it's like, yeah, yes is not as important as sanity, and I'm going to have to say no for things, or not put my heart into something is not an option. I want to put my heart into everything. So, yeah. Like, there are times where I question a lot of, like, you know, sync stuff, especially where, like, why am I doing this? Why am I chasing this?
But I know, man.
There's a part of it, too, where it's like, you know, I have this other side of my brain where it's like, yo, isn't this why you learn music, to be able to make something fly? 22 for me, I'm like, yes and no all the time, and I have to, like, balance it. But really it comes down to, is my heart into it, yes or no? And if it's not, then it's like, it's a big no. It just has to be.
Yeah, that's really been, and it's actually been very, very difficult for me to learn how to say no. It's been really, really, it's been crazy, but it's been good.
That's awesome. So, well, let's play something else. What do you want to play us next?
Well, speaking of sort of the more commercial side of things, but also the having fun art side of things, I'm in this pretend band called Dumb Cats with my friend Ben Lashes. He was in the Lashes. They were on Columbia in the mid-2000s or late 2000s. Anyway, they did really well. And he and I have been doing a project called Night Callers. And then there's also other sort of like really, really dumb stuff, like trying to get down to the most bare bones idea that we can do and just having fun with it and being like really unprecious about like, okay, we're going to spend 20 minutes making this thing. I'm going to send it to you. You're going to send me back the Logic session. I'm going to take 10 minutes to mix this. We're throwing it into the mastering stuff and we're releasing it tomorrow morning. And it just feels so good to do that. And right. So this is something that we did kind of as a joke. I mean, this is like our own, we're getting high on our own supply, just having fun, right? But getting high on your own supply isn't cool when you're listening to something 20,000 times in a row, right? Because then you don't have any perspective. So as long as you can be disciplined to have the most fun that you can possibly have, and then force yourself to like, let it go, put it out while it's fresh. I don't want to be last year's dress. So this is a very silly thing, Dumb Cats. And this is a song about chicken sandwiches that we made about the craze when Popeye's chicken sandwiches were, people were like fighting over the lack of supply chain issues and stuff. And so we made this song because it's just such a funny subject. And then what happened is Popeye's hit found it. We just released it. No promotion, no marketing scammers, no PR scammers taking our money. We just put it out. And then Popeye's found it and they used it in a radio ad.
That's amazing.
The full song is more funny than the radio ad, but the radio ad's pretty good too. And they paid us really well and they've used it in a radio ad and we're like, okay, so we had the most fun we could. We didn't take ourselves seriously at all. I mean, go ahead and play it. I'm the singer on this, if that gives you any idea of what, how stupid it is.
All right. Sandwiches. I read on Twitter that it has lots of advantages, but when I got that they were out of chicken sandwiches, I'm going to lose my mind. I want to chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. I went to Popeye's once again for chicken sandwiches. There was a line around the block, our hunger ravages, but when it was my turn to order, they had no more sandwiches. I'm going to lose my mind. I want a chicken sandwich. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. I went to Popeye's one more time for chicken sandwiches. I have a craving so intense I cannot handle it. The guy in front of me in line bought the last sandwiches. I lost my mind, I only wanted chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. I want my chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches. Chicken sandwiches.
So yeah, there's that. So I guess there's a little bit of dead time at the end of that video, but
Right, that was
yeah.
what. Not only did it make me extremely hungry, but dude, I was laughing during the whole thing. It was like, this is amazing. It's kind of an amazing track. It's so simple.
I'm really happy with it, and we're actually doing more, and we're kind of steering that project, minus the video of people fighting, because that was kind of like the funny thing, but we're kind of steering that project more towards like a kids thing. So like we have a song called Mozzarella, Mozzarella, and that's basically the only lyric. We have a song called Toys. That's pretty much the main lyric. So we're just like kind of trying to pick one word and make something dumb. And I mean, I feel like the only reason that I'm not like a crazy millionaire is just that I haven't done a dumb enough idea yet. Like,
Right.
as soon as I find the dumb enough idea, then I'll be way more successful.
You know,
So I'm on the hunt for that.
it's funny. It's like always.
Oh no, it's more gratifying because it took me 20 minutes to make that. And the other stuff I do could take me days and whatever, long periods of time. So the fact that it took me zero time to make that and we got paid for it, like that's the big win. And that makes me know that I'm on the right track by running as fast as I can. I've spent the last couple decades just sprinting permanently away from my virtuosity. So the idea that less is more, I didn't make that up. I'm a student of the philosophy that less is more, which is ironic because I'm an orchestrator and so my job is to add more. But really, it does make sense because it's so easy to add too much more. It's better to add just the right amount of more. And less more is still more.
Well, and it's also there's probably a little bit of like a vacation or departure from what you're doing day to day so that it becomes
Yeah.
exciting because it's completely different than anything you're doing, right?
Well, yeah, and I also just think that a lot of today's musical geniuses are in the comedy and not serious realm. So, like, and a lot of, you're right, it is a departure because a lot of times, especially as a cellist growing up in the 90s, you can imagine all the sad flannel shirt music that everybody wanted me to play on. And it just got kind of old after a while. It's like, I already live in Seattle. I never see the sunshine. I don't want to just spend my whole day playing wah, 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 wah. Oh, you know, so I look for major chords. I look for fun. I look for upbeat things to be involved in. That's what kind of like why I like the Subaru Crosstrek song too. It's like fun spirited. You don't have to just be that typical wah, wah, sad thing with an orchestra. You can, there's so many cool things you can do. And actually, that's why I like spooky stuff too. And like horror stuff and scary stuff. There's a thing called Sprite Fright. We can't play it because it's the whole movie. But if you look it up on YouTube, it's called Sprite Fright. It'll show right up. And we wrote some really fun songs for that with my band Tennis Pro. And there's actually,
By the way,
yeah. Oh, thank you.
do you play?
My guitar player plays tennis.
Okay, all right.
I actually don't.
I play tennis every week. That's why I'm like,
Oh,
okay,
nice.
I'm into it. So yeah,
Awesome.
it's great.
Good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's been a band since 03. We're still around. We just played a show on Sunday, and we're still doing our thing. And actually that's one of the links I have for you too today to watch when it's time. So, but Sprite Fright is also a Tennis Pro related thing in that the songs, not the soundtrack, but the songs that are incorporated, there's a handful of songs and those are all Tennis Pro and they're pretty fun. Very, they wanted a very like 80s new wave kind of throwback thing. And so that was really fun. That was like a fun bar to try to jump over or through a little hoop to jump through. Is like get that right 80s new wave character going on. And it helped that we were alive in the 80s doing, you know, we've been there, done that. So
I don't think I've ever asked you this. Like, who are some of your favorite composers? Like classical, Baroque, Romantic, some of those arrangements.
Well, I love Arvo Pärt because he's able to do really dark stuff and still have a certain amount of minimalism and also repetition to it. But of course, I love Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff. I would say Rimsky-Korsakov is really high on the list because of his because he was a naval officer and he went all over the world and, you know, call it appropriation, but he was able to glean things from different cultures from around the world and incorporate that into sort of that classical realm. So when it comes to composers, that's one of my favorites.
I just learned, my dad told me that Rachmaninoff lived in LA for a little bit.
I'm wow, like, what? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. It's cool. So crazy. So it's just bizarre that, you know, these composers, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, they're like, they're almost like statues, you know, like they're like these huge pillars of music. And to think they have these living, breathing lives, just like all of us, you know, same frustrations, you know, it's kind of amazing. For me, it's like, I love Brahms. I'll always love Mozart because he did the most with so little and just made it so accessible. I feel like he and Bach like invented pop music for me. Like
Pretty much.
They are that are the foundation for it. So and then there's somebody like, you know, I would say I love the opera, like Puccini. Puccini is like my dude when it comes to string arrangements, because I don't feel like anybody writes opera like that. You know, like the string arrangements in Puccini's operas or Donizetti, all the Italians, the 20th century Italian guys, they just knew string arrangements in a way that nobody did it like that, you know? So there are these periods where I definitely find that I'm drawn to string ensemble or arrangements. It's such a gift of what you are able to do and contribute. What do you want to play us next?
Well, there's a song called Kimberly Pick the Weeds by Tennis Pro, which is the band that I mentioned before. It has some really nice French horn parts in it. And I think you could probably... I do play horns, but actually this is my buddy Jacob Lashes from The Lashes. Again, it's all fam. But yeah, I think it actually is a good example of... I think you can kind of see through the silly, poppy... facade and kind of hear some of those classical formal roots in the writing. So yeah, cool. And it's also a really trippy cartoon, so have fun.
Awesome, I'm looking forward to it. Here it is.
Yeah.
Phil.
What a beautiful garden. What kind of shochu was that? Are you guys seeing this?
Trippy.
Man, my words look like bad subtitles from a foreign film. Projectionist isn't paying any... that's better. What is all this?
Record your lyrics, Phil.
Lyrics? She's fond of working in her garden all day. She's fond of working in her garden. In her garden, you know.
Ooh, Irish lady, tell me, how does your garden grow? Kimberly picked the weeds while Anthony mows. Cleans the pond.
Record your lyrics, Phil.
Holy shit.
That was awesome, dude. Very peppers of you. It's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah, so I mean, I think when you're talking about opera, really the form with the and then lets you, takes you there, you know, very operatic in its approach.
Totally. So. I loved it. That was very cool. And what was really neat was, like, you know, seeing everybody's expressions. Because, I mean, it's like just pushing creativity, too. It's like, okay. Oh, you got a session going on right now. I love it.
Yeah, I have a band practicing in here. I figured I'd show that off a little
That's
bit.
That's awesome. Well, you know what? On behalf
they
of
They sound great.
For me and again, Wake Up Hollywood, Philip, where can people find you if they want to hire you for strings or to have you play on their record?
Philip-Peterson.com. So Philip with two L's. So Philip Peterson, and I mean, if you just Google search Philip Peterson Orchestra or Philip Peterson Cello or something like that, you'll find my website and my emails on there. So that's a good way. But also, you know, I'm on Twitter a lot. I'm in Twitter spaces a lot because I'm also in a bunch interview that we could do some other time.
Too, because I'm starting that same thing. And
yeah.
I seem to be on that path too. So we'll have to collaborate on some future records too, man. We'll have to make
this happen. Absolutely, especially if it's fun.
Yes.
So yeah, also House of Breaking Glass is my studio / production company. So you can find that, and then you can find me on Instagram and all that stuff. So I'm pretty easy to find.
You are a tremendously talented individual. We're so happy that you were a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have to follow up and have you back on the show as you keep doing more songs, more productions. And thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, man.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me. That was a blast.
Of course,
man. That
was
fun.
Peace and love. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Philip, we'll see you guys next week. Tune in. Take care of each other. Keep yourselves good.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.